This is DGMT's Learning Lunch, and I'm your host, Rahima Aesop. Today we are talking about empowering community-based organizations through something called trust-based funding, and what it means for donors to give more decision-making power to NGOs and communities. So the anchor for this conversation is a relatively new initiative called Sukutula Unmute and Act. It's a multi-year initiative co-funded by DGMT, the Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation, and Charlize Theron Africa Outreach Project. The initiative supports community-based organizations responding to gender-based violence in four districts in the Eastern Cape and Limpopo. Joining me today to talk about this initiative is Zandile Mqwati, Project Manager for Gender-Based Violence Initiatives at DGMT. Welcome, Zandi. It's so nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
So the Eastern Cape and Limpopo have high rates of gender-based violence and have been marked as GBV hotspots, but the funding flows to community-based organizations in these particular provinces are not adequate to respond to GBV. The Sukutula Unmute and Act initiative wants to change this by opening cash flows to organizations that typically don't have access to funding and to strengthen the capacity of these CBOs, that's community-based organizations. But that's not all. One of the main features of trust-based funding is that decision-making power is often shared between the funder and the grantee. This collaborative approach recognizes the expertise of local organizations. This sounds amazing, and I'm sure that the organizations listening to this podcast, their ears are perking up right now and they want to hear more. So what are some of the features of trust-based funding that make this approach a good fit for CBOs?
This model is less hierarchical and it's less traditional. And really, it's about flipping the script on conventional power dynamics. And we're doing that with the hope that there's more impact in the sector. It is also based on shifting the power, as you mentioned, to CBOs so that they are able to decide the priorities for funding in their own context. I mean, you agree with me or anyone listening that CBOs are experts of their own communities and they will know best where the funding is needed most.
That's interesting, and I'm reminded of a Black Eyed Peas song which goes, "Where is the love?" And I want to ask you, Zandile, where is the trust in traditional funding?
I think, so two things. What I'm hearing is traditional funding, how does it operate? And another one is how, in granular now, does this trust-based funding model function? The traditional one, oftentimes, it's around the grant maker knows what they're funding. So there's a call out for funding, for instance. We would like to fund in organizations, CBOs, that are going to run awareness campaigns in their communities. It's an example. Or we would like to fund CBOs that provide shelter for survivors of GBV. In this instance, in a trust-based funding model, we're saying we want to fund CBOs that are aimed at responding and preventing GBV in their communities. An organization can apply and say, okay, we want to provide shelter. The other one can say, no, we want to respond by going to schools and teaching young boys, you know, dismantling, you know, this toxic role of being a man in communities and so on.
What are the risks then of this model, and how are these risks mitigated by the funder?
The first one is lack of accountability. So if we don't provide grantees or CBOs clear guidelines, there's a risk of funds being misused. When grantees submit their reports, which is expected every 6 months, it will be accompanied by a financial report, and that financial report has to have a bank statement. Why? Okay, we want to see if this 100,000 that you have put down for, I don't know what activity that you were doing, it's actually reflecting in the bank statement. So there is a bit, there's a piece around accountability, and then it can create dependency. That's another risk. And a sense of complacency in seeking other forms of support. And then another risk is in equitable distribution. So there's a risk that funds may not reach all deserving organizations or communities equally. Outside of the internal, checks that DGMT did, we had a community panel of about 10. They were the ones who decided of this group who needs to be looked into for further funds. So now the challenge is, someone might have not reviewed the document in its entirety. So then some people will not be considered for funding based on, if I was reviewing that application that day, I had a lot of other work to do, I didn't look at it. I'm referring to the panel, the community panel member. And then the last risk is limited oversight. So trust-based models may lack robust monitoring and evaluation mechanisms, resulting in difficulties in assessing impact and accountability. We have been engaging in a process with an MNE expert to develop a monitoring and evaluation framework for this process. We're going to test it out. And how we want to mitigate these risks is by clearly providing clear guidelines to grantees, and we have done that. Every grantee that we are supporting through the Sugutula initiative has been given a grant agreement, and in that grant agreement is a very binding document that is detailed around our relationship. It's not necessarily one of power us over them, but it's around, this is some of the housekeeping that ought to be put in place for this process to be impactful.
As trust-based funders, DGMT and the cohort of funders are assisting with capacity. Just elaborate very briefly on what that capacity support looks like.
Grantees, some of the grantees in this cohort don't have the resources to submit documents online. And one will ask themselves, then how did they apply? Mm. They had to go to an internet cafe, walk there or take a taxi. And we are also considering the needs, or rather the resources versus what we are asking of them. But in terms of the capacity building aspect, we had to internally look into, we have, insight into different service providers that are specializing in key areas, and we have been in communication with those service providers. We are in the process now of narrowing down the list or the people that are going to hold this process, and in collaboration with us now, the funders, with the service providers, we'll develop a training plan. But this training or capacity building process will happen in three phases. So year one, we start with the basics or the core, which is leadership and governance. I mean, this is where we're going to delve into, issues around who are you as a leader, and considering the current climate, as well as the shifts in terms of how things are looking. We know there's a lot of the organizations rely, for instance, on DSD as a co-funder, and having them being aware of that, and us as funders using this model, we want to capacitate them to be able to, in the future, be able to access, bigger funders, so we're not there to say, okay, every day we're going to take you to, no, it's not that relationship. It's to say, this is how you get there, and this is what you're going to need how to get there, and let's help you find what you need to get there. And at some point, we trust that you can find your way to get there.
Thanks, Andy. I would be remiss in my position as communications director at DGMT if I didn't use your prompt to say that to all those listening, there are guides for NGOs on DGMT's website. If you go to dgmt.co.za and you go to guides for NGOs, you will find guides on monitoring and evaluation, as well as governance and setting up an NGO. So that's just a little plug to guide people to that particular resource that exists on DGMT's website. But back to regular programming, what are the benefits of trust-based funding?
The main one is around deepening relationships between the funder and the grantee, or the funder and the recipient, to promote flexibility in how funding is being used, and also to empower organizations to be able to address community needs effectively. So looking at more community-embedded interventions. And lastly, to encourage innovation. So just because there's flexibility, and I'll chat more about this when I talk in practice, CBOs were able to say, okay, this is how we, and this is how we want to, you know, and we back that up. But of course, as I mentioned, there are mechanisms that we've put in place to be able to see if this this approach is working in terms of their, you know, activities or their programming. And also it creates and it fosters collaboration between funders. So right now, you know, we have a beautiful developing, you know, because we are learning, and it's a very interesting approach in terms of looking at the community, not as one who's coming to give the solution, but looking into the community and saying, community, please help us. How do we find a solution, and making the resources available?
The initiative has enrolled its first cohort. How many CBOs have been enlisted, and what happens next?
So just to give a bit of more context, in total, we received from Limpopo and Eastern Cape 136 applications. And through a series, like a deep series of reviewing and making sure that, you know, the kinds of CBOs that are part of this or possibly will be part of this cohort are represented. We then followed up. We ended up with, you know, a number of declined applications. Out of this 136, we had 99 declines. And those declines, what is unique or what is different from with our approach or the trust-based model approach is that each and every one of these organizations received a personalized decline. What that means and why. So-and-so, unfortunately or regrettably, you didn't, you know, this cohort due to this reason. So that an organization, upon receiving that, they're able now to look into that and then apply themselves and apply to another, you know, funder. And then in total, we're left with 37 grantees. So we have a cohort and there's 37 organizations. What is next for them? So we have gone through a lengthy process of contracting or making sure that, you know, legally that things are done well and processing their first tranches. They've just received their first tranches and they will now, most of them have started actually implement, because what they did, speaking back to the trust-based funding model, they submitted activity plans, what they want to achieve by when and how is that going to look like. So now they're doing that in practice. And after 6 months, this is around June, you know, we are expecting reports. And this report, as I mentioned, for accountability, is going to not just be a narrative which we developed a simple template for getting core to the data now to say there's certain things that obviously we want to look at for to track any progress or impact, and of course alongside with the financial report. What's next for this cohort? Around May, we're looking at having two of the workshops each per province. So we'll have a workshop in Limpopo for the Limpopo-based cohort members, and we'll also have another workshop in Eastern Cape.
Is this a community practice workshop where they learn from each other? What is the goal of these workshops? Yes.
So we're not yet there. So the contents of the training or the workshops will look, for instance, leadership. The role of the board, identifying your board member, what is the role of a board member, community mapping, because a lot of these activities are designed with the community in mind. But there's also a need for these grantees to look at who's in the room in terms of their, you know, other cohort members who are located in the same province so that they work in unison. So we also finding a way to kind of bring CBOs together and dismantle this thinking around, you know, CBOs don't work together.
Given the limited resources in these particular communities, describe how these small community-based organizations are responding to gender-based violence. Perhaps you can give us some details in terms of what these organizations are actually doing.
So there's a number of CBOs that make up this cohort from the two provinces. So we looked at organizations that are women-led, youth-led, queer community led, and also with the disabled community inconsiderate or being part of those processes. For instance, there's an organization in Eastern Cape, Yawe, Center for the Disabled. So what Yawe does, they have a small group of young people, different age groups. They've got a group of, you know, infants to toddlers, where they teach them your basic skills around being able to communicate. This is in a rural setting. So for someone that might sound like, oh, that's so basic. But this is for the community that oftentimes the disabled child doesn't get to engage with the rest of the community. And because one, either the mother has to go and work and they don't have the resources. I mean, Raima, we both parents, we know childcare can be crazy. They oftentimes end up by themselves locked up somewhere. So Yahweh does take these children and put them in this class. And then for the older ones, they are taught, you know, skills to be able to generate some kind of income. But what are some of the things that Yahweh does, and I'm highlighting them, is that they've got a small garden at the back. They've got it's just a tiny yard at the back of the shack that they use as an office. And one of the things that they had applied for the application they got awarded for is to get a container so that they move from that shack, because it was, you know, when it rains, the water comes in. When it's cold, you can imagine. So they have a small garden where this young people, they harvest thyme, rosemary, herbs, and they have made this ointment. That ointment, it can be used for eczema. But another organization is Zwelitsha. Zwelitsha is also in the Eastern Cape. It is run by a group of elderly women. The founder was a wife of a local council who has since passed, as I mentioned, they're elderly. But what these women do, they gather together on a weekly basis. They make beads. So bead work is very big and popular in the Eastern Cape, especially in that area. They sell those during a specific time season, but also what they do, they provide counseling to survivors of GBV. And with that money, what they do, if there's a need, they provide for the survivor who comes looking for support. And within Limpopo, we have Musina Victim Empowerment. What Musina does, they have this, they are the offices or the premises within this, the police station. They have rooms there where they shelter the mother and the child, the GBV survivor. The other one in Limpopo is Renai Singai. Renai provides a foundation. They provide legal support as well as that comprises of court support. When the survivor of GBV is going to court, they provide financial support in terms of the person to be able to reach court, because sometimes even the family, if the survivor is not supported by the family members, sometimes that is also, it can impact them with the process. So they support the family members and to coordinate the whole legal process.
Zandi, what does success look like for the Sukutula initiative?
Well, the main one is for this 37 grantees to be capacitated outside of this 3 years relationship, to be able to still sustain themselves in a better position. And of course, underlying that, a reduction of GBV incidences in these communities. And hopefully, you know, the two provinces, possibly there might be this marriage of some sort where we find that the different aspects within this province are being borrowed, because they are similar but yet different, because having been exposed to them, but they are similar yet different. They have access to some of the creative ways that they can use to respond to one of the drivers of gender-based violence, which is poverty. They have learned, you know, so in terms of building, growing gardens, that's another conversation that speaks to food security. But also for us, success will look like organizations that are able to work together. So in Limpopo, in Seshego, an example, those organizations being able to come together and work together. And when they're looking for funds, they can look for funds together and outline this one. This is what we are doing. We're providing shelter. This one is providing psychosocial support. This one is doing, you know, court support. And we are all applying for one fund. And of course, and a last piece around it, it's around, you know, bringing this sense of, I can do it too. Because oftentimes, CBOs, they get like this, the power gets taken away by the mechanisms of applying for a grant. Like, oh, I have to fill this, I have to do that. Being able to move past that feeling of I can't do it, so that they are able to get the necessary resources they need to implement their very vital initiatives in their communities.
I want to summarize our conversation for the benefit of our listeners. A trust-based funding model is an approach to philanthropy and grant-making that emphasizes building strong, collaborative, and transparent relationships between funders and grantees. So unlike more traditional transactional models, trust-based funding recognizes the expertise of the organizations and seeks to empower them by providing flexible support, reducing bureaucracy, and fostering open communication. And now, over to you, those listening to this podcast. Using what you have heard today, you can try this reflective exercise. You'll need a pen and paper to write down these steps or download the takeaway sheet from our website, dgmt.co.za. Remember to go to the Resources tab. Write down the following questions and spend some time reflecting on them by yourself, and then share your reflections with your colleagues. Question number one. How do you think funders can best support community-based organizations to implement programs at a community level? Question number two. At a community level, what do you think is lacking in GBV prevention and response efforts? And question number three. How might trust-based funding affect the relationship between funders and grantees in positive and negative ways? This has been DGMT's Learning Lunch. Until next time.